It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
First of all, I wanted to start off and, start things off talking about Red Hook Summer. And for people who don't know the connection, can you talk a little bit about how you and Spike Lee first started working together?
Well, right. That's the Spike and Bruce combo is one of many sort of odd couples that I've been a part of for many years. It's mostly people who don't know much about me who go, "Wow, what a strange combination." I think some people probably would have said that when I was playing with the Dead, but they didn't really know the whole story at all. So, anyway, this is like that. I met him. It's very natural how all this comes about. It's just about sort of mutual admiration societies. In this case, I met Spike through our longtime mutual friend, Branford Marsalis. And Branford and I were starting to play together a little bit in the early 90s. And he introduced me to Spike. And Spike professed his interest in my music. And I asked him, "Well, then, okay, if you like it, will you do a video for me?" And he said, "Yeah, absolutely." So the first time we worked together was 1992 on the Talk of the Town video for the Harbor Lights record. And so it had me being a cab driver around New York City. That was quite an adventure for me. And it was Spike in the back seat screaming, "Turn here, turn there, stop, slam on the brakes." So it was quite memorable, really an enjoyable 2 days. Branford played a street musician playing sax on Fifth Avenue or wherever. And that was the first time we worked together. And we just kept on through the years. Two years later, he was making his movie Clockers, the great movie Clockers. And he asked me to write an end title song for his movie. So I was getting ready to write a song with Chaka Khan at the time. She had asked me to write a song with her. And so we ended up steering that song to Spike. And so that song was the first song I had in one of the Spike's movies. It's called Love Me Still.
It's
funny that, well, thanks. It's interesting how that song has had its own little sort of under the radar screen life. Lots of singers have recorded the song. There's an amazing version recorded by this great Atlanta gospel singer named Gabriel. He just calls himself Gabriel on the record, but I think his name is Gabriel Potter, and he's a transcendent singer. His version of this song to me is the archetype. It's the quintessential version.
That's high praise given that Chaka.
Well, yeah. Oh, look, Chaka is unparalleled. I mean, she's one of the greats, of course. I just feel that. Look, you'd have to hear the two. And it's a high barrier. It's a high bar to get over with Chaka Khan having done it first. But anyway, this song has had an interesting life. I played on Jimmy Fallon about a year and a half ago. And I played for the whole night, and the Roots and I were rehearsing. And we were finishing the rehearsal, and the keyboard player said to me, okay, I said, "Well, okay, I guess we're finished." And the keyboard player said, "Hey, listen, man, can we play Love Me Still with you?" So I said, "Sure." And so we started playing it. This was really funny. And then Questlove started playing drums, and he started playing this. He said, "Let's do it differently." So he started playing this really laid-back shuffle. And I started playing along with him, and he said, "Hey, man, play it like you're drunk." And I said, "Well, okay, I'm not sure what," I'm saying this to myself, "well, I'm not sure exactly what he means by that, but I think I'll try to do something to that effect." And I think basically what he wanted me to do was lay the time really back of the beat, which was, of course, the right thing to do. And so I loved doing that way. We ended up doing it with my band a couple of times right after that, just because it was great fun. Anyway, that was the first song I had in a Spike movie. Then 2000. Then he did a video for me on my Hot House record, a song called Swing Street, and where we had some beautiful transvestites. One transvestite who looked like Dick Butkus. It was just fantastic. then 2001, he called me to ask me if I would write and record another entitled song for his movie Bamboozled, and one of the underrated films in his oeuvre. Anyway, I wrote a song called Shadowland for that, and so he just liked what I was doing for him. Then another, it seemed like I was getting a call from him about every 6 or 7 years. Then I got a call from him in 2009 to do a score for him for a Kobe Bryant documentary on ESPN called Kobe Doing Work. So that was the first score I did for him. I guess he liked that enough that he called me again in 2011 to work on Red Hook Summer as an actual film score. And he wanted it very low, very, very bare bones. It's just a piano. It's just piano music. And he wanted it totally stripped down. So that's what I did. And he liked that enough that he's asked me to do his new one now. It's called Old Boy. It's a remake of a great Korean cult classic of the same name. And Josh Brolin is in it, Samuel L. Jackson, and he's shooting it now.
Have you seen the original?
I sure have. Oh yes, I got the original. He sent me the original, which is fantastic.
It's also violent as hell.
Oh, it's very dark. It's very intense.
Anybody who's seen the original and hears that you're doing the music for the remake.
Well, there you go. Then you're doing one of those things that I was just talking about. Oh, wow, what a strange combo. You know, when in the end, you know, hopefully you'll go, oh, okay, I get it. Just sort of like, once again, I was mentioning The Dead. You know, people went, oh, my God. I remember this great review of one of the early Dead shows that I played at the Garden. And this guy was very upfront about it. He said, I was very skeptical about this. I thought Bruce Hornsby was going to come in and inflict some dreaded top 40 disease on the Grateful Dead.
Jesus.
Then I went to the concert, and it couldn't have been a more natural pairing. They didn't realize that I'd played in my older brother's Grateful Dead cover bands in 1974, Bobby Hightest and the Octane Kids. We played frat parties and grain alcohol parties at University of Virginia in the spring of 74. Yes, that's the right year. And they also wouldn't have realized that we opened for the Dead for 4 straight years before I actually joined up with them for a while to help them through this tough time after Brent Midland died. We opened for him probably 6 or 7 times over the 4 years previous, and so the previous 4 years, and so it was very natural for people who were paying attention. But of course, at the same time, I don't expect people to pay attention. They don't have enough time. There's not enough time to pay attention to this, to all this. You know, not unimportant music material. So anyway, I get it, but I always get a kick out of someone who goes, wow, had no idea this is what... It's just kind of the story of my life for the past many years, 10, 15 years, sort of a I had no idea reaction.
You've always seemed pretty magnanimous about all that, and I'm always impressed by that because it seems it's the type of thing... that would maybe put a chip on your shoulder after a while.
Well, I just think, once again, I feel like I just expressed. I have a line in one of my old songs from the Hot House record. It's called The Changes. It's a song about the years where we were trying to get away with playing as much jazz as we could to the great indifference of the audience. And one of the line is in there is, nobody cares, and why should they? And that's how I feel. I don't expect people to keep up with all this, this disparate, crazy journey through bluegrass worlds and jazz worlds and, you know, modern classical worlds. You know, it's my own sort of singular path, and it's led me to some amazing areas and working with amazing people. But I don't expect people to really be interested. Why should they? They got enough to do.
My reason for asking that question, Jeff and I were actually talking about this beforehand. On paper, your combination with Lee is such a interesting thing. But for anybody like, say, myself and Jeff that are Hornsby fans, the combination makes a lot of sense because, both you and Spike, I think, seem to like to work in a way that's, you know, perhaps contrary to what's expected from you. So it makes complete sense from my side of things. I guess the only other thing I'll toss in with that is when somebody like Spike Lee, you know, came to you and was interested in working with you, did you have any thought from your side, you know, before knowing that he's a fan or any of that kind of stuff, you know, oh, that's interesting. You know, what does this guy want to do with me?
Well, once again, if you remember, I asked him originally to do the video with me. He didn't approach me, but I guess when he approached me afterwards, yeah. So I guess there was a time after that, during the Clocker, making the Clockers movie, when he did approach me, and I just felt, you know, we'd become friends by then. We'd actually gone to a Knick game or two together, and some college basketball games. We're both basketball fans, and so we'd become friends by then, and I didn't really think twice about it. We were friends, and I knew he liked what I did, and so he was looking for a bit of that spice on his for his movie. So no, it didn't seem that strange to me.
Gotcha.
And there's the other phone ringing. We'll get that in there for.
Bruce Hornsby is a very busy man.
Yeah. It's good to know that the Bruce Hornsby hotline is always you know, ringing, and hopefully. Hopefully one of those phone calls will come in and it'll have you, you know, at some point doing an album with The Roots, since you mentioned The Roots.
I would love that.
Yeah, or maybe Trent Reznor, just to really mess with people who, you know, who are always wondering, well, what's this, what's going to happen next that we don't expect and that we're surprised about? You know, I think the whole thing about expectations, you know, when you have big hit records for a few years like I did from 86 to 90, that you achieve the situation where there's a whole lot of people who know a little bit about you, so you know, even during those that time, I was doing that, but then I recorded Bluegrass with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and started playing with the Dead. Even back then, I started playing on records for great people, and a lot of people might have gone, well, wait a minute, that's not how we've typecast him. You know, we think of him as this radio guy. When that was really a big fluke, frankly. I mean, Way It is hardly the formula for pop success. You know, a song about racism with not one but two improvised piano solos. I mean, that's just not what the radio's ever been about. So it was just a fluke, a wonderful accident, as I've called it for years. And it, you know, broke in England first, and then in Europe, and then throughout the rest of the world, and then in the United States. So that's the situation. Whereas if you come out and you don't have that, but you build sort of more underground, under the mainstream radar screen career, you have a smaller number of people who know everything about you, and that's sort of where, you know, my career, as far as my career is really sort of gone in that direction since the first few years of sort of radio ubiquity.
Are you comfortable with where things are at?
Well, I'm comfortable with being able to do exactly what I want to do and working with great with people who I love to work with personally and musically. And so that, sure, hell yeah, I'm comfortable with it. I never let that define me. I mean, how could I? I'm a schooled musician. I'm really interested. I'm a lifelong student, and I'm always interested in being inspired. I'm always looking for new inspiration. And I'm always looking to remain inspired. That leads me to some maybe off the wall places for people who sort of live in one musical world all their lives, but that's what I'm about. So I'm at the point where, you know, 26 years into this, the phone's still ringing, and on the other line are fantastic musicians who I love to and artists who I love to work with. So yeah, hell yeah, Am I satisfied with where it is now? Sure.
I think it keeps things, you know, exciting for both sides, because certainly, you know, it keeps you, you know, stimulated. But then from our side, you know, it's like we never know whether you're going to be, you know, doing something with Ricky Skaggs or, you know, like the Camp Meeting record or a new solo record. So it's nice being able to just, you know, just see what Bruce is in the mood to do now and, you know, and get that CD and see where it goes.
Well, right. Another great avenue that we've been exploring for several years now is the musical Sick Bastard.
Yeah.
Yep. And we've got some potentially great situation going on with Sick Bastard right now, and I can't really talk about it, but it could be amazing if it works out. We have some interest from a beautiful place. So anyway, Sick Bastard is a is something I'm, it was one of the productions that I'm most proud of. I really am proud of the songs that we've been writing. I've been writing the songs with my old kindergarten friend, Chip DiMatteo. We were best friends as kids. We had a band booking company in our town called Zappo Productions, where we would only book the worst bands in our town. And we would reserve the right to name the bands. So we had such names as, we had such bands as The Uncommon Cold, The Benign Tumor, The Soul Basketball, Polynomial and the Logarithms. That was what was known as a chick singer band back then. Polynomial being the chick singer. So it was just kids getting away with seeing what they could get away with. We wrote a musical in high school called Schenectady. It was when it was popular to name bands after towns like Chicago, say. So we called our band Schenectady. We called it Schenectady. It was either Poughkeepsie or Schenectady for us. And so we wrote this play called Schenectady, and we finagled a situation where we could we got it produced as the high school drama club production of my friend's high school. And then we wrote a sequel to that called Son of Schenectady. And so we had these crazy songs. We were just, you know, fooling around, but we liked what we were doing. And so all these years later, we're still doing it. So we just consider that we're doing Zappo Productions on a higher level.
I wanted to talk to you about the speed with which these musical projects come together for the stage. It seems like every time you hear about a recording artist mounting a production like this, you know, whether it's Randy Newman, or Mellencamp and Stephen King.
It's very difficult. Yeah, I know where you're going.
Yeah, it sounds like it takes about 10 years.
At least I read where King and Mellencamp have been working on their Ghosts of Darkland County musical for 13 years. So, yeah. But you know, when you say that, I mean, when you hear 13 years, you clearly that's not what they haven't been working on strictly this musical for 13 years. I mean, obviously, you know, so it's really misleading to make that statement about 13 years. It's sort of like, say, when my record came out, Levitate, in 2009, and someone would say, and accurately, that it's his first studio record since 2004's Halcyon Days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right, but that's not taken into consideration that there were three albums between that, you know, that time, the jazz record, the bluegrass record, and the box set. So you look at that and you go, you know what, okay, you're right, but that doesn't tell the whole story at all. So certainly in almost every case here where you hear a musical that's taking forever, it's not what it seems at all, of course. So, but it just speaks to how difficult it is to get something mounted on the Broadway stage. And it totally makes sense when you think about it, because one, almost every Broadway musical bombs. You know, the percentages are really terrible there. The mass populace only really hears about the hits, you know, the fantastic successes like the Book of Mormon, which, you know, deserves every bit of its success. It's absolutely a stunning work. I think it's just hilarious and so well done, so clever and creative. But most people don't hear about those. But also because of that, too, investors are hard to come by, because why would someone invest in something where the percentage of success is so low? And so someone has to be really, really knocked out by what you're doing to want to invest the high dollar amounts that it costs to mount a Broadway musical. So that's really the reason to me why it's so difficult. And mm-hmm. So those two reasons that sort of go together, sort of intertwined. So there you go. Doesn't that make sense to you?
Yeah, and it seems like
it's just
as
hard.
As a guy who makes his living in part by touring with a piano in this economy, you'd be pretty well acquainted with the sort of vagaries of trying to make money with art in the 21st century.
Well, you're talking about making money with the piano on the road. That has become a great area for me, because sort of unfortunately, my solo concerts outdraw my band concerts generally so often. And I don't know why that is, but because I love playing with the band. We just have a great time playing. We've been playing a lot of the great American festivals the last couple of years, you know, the Bonnaroos and New Orleans Jazz Festival, Wani, Gathering the Vibes, Telluride, of course, which we've been playing for years anyway, but all those great festivals, we love doing them. Umphrey's McGee's Festival, what's it called, Summer Camp.
Yep.
We really like those, all good festivals. So we do that with the band a lot, but the solo thing has been really great for me. Didn't one of you guys come to one of my solo shows?
Yeah, in Keene, just a...
Okay, in Keene. Okay, well, that's something I've really been dealing with intensely lately. I'm really just trying to take that to another level. And so a lot of the audience is probably not there for what I'm doing. Inflicting a lot of modern classical music on them. Which one of y'all were there? Was Aaron Keene?
That Jeff? Was me.
Jeff?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. I thought I was going to see you at the gig, but I thought you were on the backstage list. But anyway, so I guess you got an idea of what I'm doing, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And was it what you expected? Probably, because you know what I do.
I have learned to expect the unexpected.
Okay, so it was unexpected, a lot of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's part of the pleasure of being a fan of yours. You know what
I
mean?
Well, I appreciate your open-mindedness. Yeah, I try to be really nice to the soft cores. I play...
the soft cores, that's good.
Well, I play, you know, for the people who are there for their nostalgic night out, for their stroll down memory lane. Yeah. It's not much of a stroll in my case. I only had, you know, 5 or 6 hits. It's not like, you know, going to see, you know, Elton John or something. My God, you know, he could play 2 nights worth of hits and not repeat. But right, I'm not there. I think I'm being nice. Of course, I don't play them like the records, so I hope they sort of recognize them. But anyway, I hope to put out a solo concerts record in the next year or so. And so I grade the shows. I think Keene was pretty good, not one of the best, but pretty good. I'm trying to get better at it. I'm trying to like it. So anyway, that's a real intense pursuit for me right now, is really becoming strong at the solo piano concert, in the solo piano concert area.
You mentioned in answering that last question that you're working to you know, take those solo concerts to the next level. From your perspective, what does that mean to you?
Well, it means a lot of things. It's a very difficult, okay, it's a really, the solo concerts are a pretty ambitious attempt at deep musicianship. But I like that a lot of it's kind of rooted in basic American music forms like blues, boogie, even old stride piano, folk music, the hymnal, New Orleans piano. But also with a lot of influence coming from the modern classical world. The great writer Alex Ross has a great description of modern classical music. He calls it that obscure pandemonium on the outskirts of culture. I love that. And so I'm inflicting some of that obscure pandemonium onto my poor, unsuspecting audience. And there's, you know, so that's what the concert is to me. It's an ambitious attempt at doing something very difficult. And so, okay, so I can speak very specifically about it. There's a song from our musical. It's called "Where No One's Mad." It's the second to the latest song we've written. We have a new song called "Life in the Psychotropics" about psychotropic drugs, which is our latest one that we've written for the musical. Just writing it actually right now. So this song, "Where No One's Mad," it's really influenced by a couple of great composers. Elliot Carter, the great American composer who just died a couple of weeks ago, 1 month shy of his 104th birthday. So what a life he had.
Yeah.
And I love his music. It's and so there's a piece of his that I've been working on for the last 3 years, and some of that has made its way into this "Where No One's Mad" tune. And there's another part of the song that's influenced by the great Hungarian composer Ligeti. A lot of people say Ligeti, but I'm pretty sure now. I've said it wrong for years. I think it's Ligeti. Anyway, he has a great set of piano pieces, his etudes, and I love those. I play one of those on the concerts also. So this song is really dealing in two. You've probably heard for years people talk about the two-handed independence that I'm interested in getting together in dealing with in the solo piano context. Well, this is two-handed independence plus the singing at the same time, and it's really, really hard to do. So it's easy to talk about it. It'd be easier to hear it, and you'd know. But there's no recording of this because it's a pretty new song. So for instance, if I'm hearing a tape of me doing Where No One's Mad, and there's lots of songs like this, I may be nailing the piano part, but it's splitting your brain. You have to know it so well and have it so under your fingers and in your head that you can play the piano and have it and not have to think about that to the point where you can really concentrate and be expressive as a singer. Lots of times I'll hear myself doing this and I'll go, well, I can tell that I'm singing this, but I'm not really in it because I'm having to concentrate on all this other stuff too, on all this other, right. These other technical aspects also. So that's one way of explaining specifically some of the problems. Just when you're trying to play a really strong groove, well, that's a lot to concentrate on right there, but then you're going to sing over it, and so that has to be sort of second nature to you. And in lots of cases, it's not. It's just it's really under the microscope. There's no net, and to do it well for me anyway is very difficult. So I guess I don't know if I've explained it. It's long winded as hell, but that's as good as I can explain it.
That works.
Well, it leads into what I wanted to ask you about, which is your practice routine. I wondered if you could talk about that. You seem to practice more than a lot of mainstream recording artists, if that makes
any
sense.
Well, mainstream, if you mean in the pop or rock world, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I just have, it's a high bar. It's like I say, it's ambitious.
Right.
It's just what I like. I've liked sort of dissonant and modern classical music since I was in college. It's only here and there found its way into my songwriting, but now more than ever, and probably mostly in the musical area, in the musical songs. Although I just wrote a song with Robert Hunter. Actually, I've written two with him this year, and I wrote one before, as you probably know, Cyclone, for the Levitate record that was also on Bride of the Noisemakers. Don't you guys like that? Bride of the Noisemakers cover?
That's awesome.
Getting married to my keyboard player in drag. It's just the happy couple. I love it.
Anyway. How's that marriage holding up?
Oh, it's a sad story. No, it's holding up fine. They live apart, so that makes it work.
Oh.
But right, Robert Hunter sends me sets of lyrics every now and then. And we wrote this song called Might As Well Be Me that I call it a dodecaphonic Dixieland tune. And and what that means is it's a sort of bluesy Dixielandish song. But the harmonic and melodic content is based on a 12-tone row, like one of my favorite composers, Schoenberg, invented, Arnold Schoenberg from Austria. And so although he lived in LA and taught at UCLA for years in his last years, anyway, so it's been influencing, or some people would say infecting, my music here for the last few years.
But
you were talking about practicing.
Else.
You're asking me about practicing. Yeah,
I
think
was,
I've kind of talked about it because I'm really practicing all these practicing to get better at these difficult areas that I was just talking about in the solo piano concert.
you're well, this kind of touches on something else, which is sort of the tyranny of musical choice as a songwriter. I mean, your vocabulary is so large that it
well,
seems
it's
like,
getting larger. Yeah, it's getting larger.
And that seems like it might create sort of a bewildering situation when you sit down to write a song where, you know.
Oh, no, no, it doesn't at all. It's all about the specific song. For instance, I go back to this song where no one's mad. It's a song about conflict between a father and a son. And so it just seemed like it wanted to have, you know, conflict is equals dissonance to me often.
Right,
and
right.
So it seemed like it wanted to be that. It's funny. As I get older, you know, people have always thought of me as sort of this jazz-influenced guy, and I have been for years, but lately not really, very little. It's funny. I've gravitated towards two very different types of music, the most dissonant modern music that we've been just talking about, and also the most simple three-chord or two-chord folk music. And those are the two musics, oddly enough, that move me the most these days. So I've written, for instance, the last two Hunter songs that we've been playing one of them live a little bit. It's called "Might as Well Be Me," and that has more of the modern chromatic language in it, even though it's a sort of a bluesy, like I said, Dixieland esque song. But then there's a new song that we've been writing that I've been writing with him called "Tropical Cashmere Sweater," that I wrote on a dulcimer. And that's very, much more simple. I like writing on the dulcimer because I'm so bad at it. It keeps me simple, you know. But there's also a song from our musical called "Soon Enough" that I wrote on the piano, but it also works great on the dulcimer. You know, at Bonnaroo, they asked me to do a dulcimer set on the small stage called the Sonic Stage. And I did that. I played every song I knew, and it took me 45 minutes. But I love doing it. I play it more and more with the band because it's just a different spice. I love it when Sonny Amory comes out and plays the washboard, and I actually think the audience really loves that too.
You know, I was going to joke about you know, whether you had space in your catalog for a dulcimer record somewhere down the line.
Oh, I totally do. I really want to do that, yes. I really want to do it. I've been listening to some of the tapes that we've done. I've actually talked to Larry Campbell. You guys know Larry Campbell?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Larry, who was leader of Levon Helm's group, has played a lot with Phil Lesh, with my great old drummer, John Molo. Larry, I know Larry from running into him in different musical situations. We were both part of, I think, the Jorma Kaukonen 70th birthday party bash a couple of years ago at the Beacon Theater. I went and played at the Levon's Midnight Ramble at his barn a couple of times last year and maybe 3 years before that. Also, Larry was the MD for the Levon tribute concert that I was a part of that was happening in the Meadowlands. Sadly, I was really pretty bad at that. You know, sometimes you're on stage and you think you're hearing yourself well, so you're singing away, and then you hear a tape and you're going, "Damn, son, you're just so out of tune." And so that was sadly for me, I'm afraid, wasn't very good that night. Anyway, Larry and I have talked about. I've talked to Larry about working with him on a dulcimer-based record. What you mentioned is something I'm already thinking about. I'd love to do.
That'd be great.
Yeah. I hope so. We're trying to put out a Skaggs Hornsby record. Speaking of that area of music, a live record, and I'm not sure when we'll get around to that. But I haven't heard from him for a little while. But he sat in with us. He and two of his killer players, Cody Kilby and Andy Leff, which sat in with us at the Floyd Fest this year, and was just a beautiful time. It's one of the great things about playing these festivals. At Telluride, we had Bela Fleck and Sam Bush and Chris Thiele play with us, and Chris Thiele is one of the freaks of nature to me. You know, he just won the MacArthur Genius Grant, one of those awards, and so we love playing with Chris. And that's something I hope to do in the future also, more and more. So, yeah, there's all sorts of stuff to do.
You know, I think you thrive on, obviously, collaborations and finding new collaborations as opposed to somebody that might, you know, want to work in the box with the same, you know, collaborators all the time. You don't seem like a guy, I would never think that you'd be a guy that would be hurting lyrically, so I'm interested to know what it is about the collaboration that you really enjoy working with Robert.
Well, I've just always loved his music. I think it's kind of, there's one common thread here. The people I work with are just people whose music I love, and people who call me, I guess they feel similarly about what I do. I think that's why you call somebody, is you're moved by what they do. Hunter reached out to me and asked me if I'd like to write a song with him. This was probably four years ago now, and I said yes, of course, absolutely, I'd love to. So he said, send me a track. So I had something, a piece of music that I thought had a certain feeling that he might respond to. And so I sent him that. And 2 weeks later, he sent me back these Cyclone words. And so that was such a sort of euphoric moment for me. But I didn't push it. I'm not really pushy in that way. I don't really call people and say, hey, let's go. Let's do something again or whatever. But he, just out of the blue, he sent me this past New Year's Day. He said, "Happy New Year, and here's some new words. Here's a set of lyrics for you." And then in the spring, he sent me another one. So, look, I hope he keeps sending them to me. But if he doesn't, three's fantastic. Three songs is great. So whether it's Robert Hunter or my friend Chip DiMatteo, I think these guys are great writers. I mean, obviously Hunter is. Hunter's acclaimed, at least certainly in a certain circle, he's revered, and I revere him. And in the case of my friend DiMatteo, I could say, you guys don't know a lot of these musical songs, but I could talk you through them and just sort of recite the lyrics to you, and you would go, yeah, go ahead, really good. If you guys know the Levitate record, for instance, he wrote the song Simple Prayer on there.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
which I think is just funny. You know, sweet Jesus, it's so vital, we win the football title, we've reached the semifinals, if we lose it, it's not fair. Our glory in your name will earn the town's acclaim. Let us win the game, that's my simple prayer. Lord, please hear my pleading while my heart is beating, my hairline's receding, losing my hair. Follicles are fallen, that Rogaine bottle's calling. Don't let me be a baldy, that's my simple prayer. I mean, to me, that's just really well done, really, really funny and smart. So, hey, I love writing with him. So I'm lucky. DiMatteo and Hunter, I found two great guys.
And you know, these guys seem to, you know, because those lyrics that you mentioned specifically, like say that Rogaine bottle's calling. Like, I think it has a very special flavor the way you deliver it. So they seem to write very well with you for your style of delivery. I mean, obviously, they know what you're about.
Well, I consider that I have two or three different styles of delivery, that it's not just one flavor, in the sense that I like to sing a soulful song, say, or an attempt at a soulful song, for instance, Fortunate Son of Mine, you know, that song, or Resting Place. Well, that has a little sort of sardonic craziness about it, but I also like to sing songs that are attempts at humor, like say, What the Hell Happened to Me, yeah, for instance, or The Dreaded Spoon. Yeah. So you know, you're going to deliver them differently, but I certainly feel like at my best I can deliver those lines about, you know, follicles are falling, and give them the right sort of lack of seriousness, if you know what I'm saying. And so, and as I get older, I'm more and more interested in writing the attempts at humor, because that's what I like. You guys have seen me live. You know, I'm not that serious a person. You've seen the covers of the records, for God's sake.
When it comes to all these projects you have in mind, to what extent do you still have to worry about labels, or to what extent do you still want to work with labels?
Labels meaning the how people describe your music, or labels meaning record companies?
Record companies.
Exactly. Oh, record companies. Well, man, I don't think about it much. I record these days for Savoy 429 Records, and they they really wanted to put out the Red Hook Summer record. They really wanted to put out the live record, Bride of the Noisemakers. And so they, you know, they're just enthusiastic. I guess I'm at a point in my life where I like people that like me. So, you know, if you don't like me, then I don't need to be involved with you, you know? I mean, it's a fairly obvious point. It sounds actually sort of trite and stupid, but there's something to it. It's very simple for me. If somebody's really passionate about something I'm doing, then I'm going to be obviously more interested in getting involved with them. And so, I don't really think about labels. But, you know, I'm lucky that I never really did. I always had a lot of support. I was with RCA Records for 18 years, and I always felt, I think it's absolutely, because my first record was so successful that they gave me wide berth. You know, they allowed me to do what I was going to do, what I wanted to do. For instance, when I made Harbor Lights, which was the first time I really utilized the jazz language in my songwriting, yeah, to a great extent. Joe Galante, the president of the label at the time, was totally supportive. I think he thought, one, it was the right thing to do. I think also he did think that I had a hit single. It wasn't really a hit. Fields of Gray, it got to number 71 with an anchor on the Billboard Hot 100. Or maybe it was 69. Maybe I cracked the top. Maybe I was a top 70. I don't know. But anyway, he was very supportive. When Bob Jameson came in, I put out the record Spirit Trail, which is to me one of my best records. It's the double record, and I say it's one of the best records because so many of the songs are so important to our live thing. We love playing. God, I could name 12 songs off that record that we play all the time live. King of the Hill, Resting Place, Preacher in the Ring 1, Preacher in the Ring 2, Pete and Manny, Fortunate Son, Great Divide, See the Same Way, on and on. There's Sunflower Cat, Fun House. And now Bob didn't think that one was very commercially viable, but he was still supportive. He basically said to me, well, this sounds like something that you needed to do. And that's really nice, you know. So I was really, you know, a lot of people bitch about the labels, and I could understand that. Certainly on an accounting level, it's easy to bitch about them, but creatively for me, I can't really bitch about them. I was fortunate. I was lucky through the years with that. Now the major labels would have no interest in me, and I don't blame them a bit. It's very much akin to what's happening in the movie business now. So many of the most interesting movies that have great artistic merit are the independents, and that's always been the case, but more so now, because just like in music, the big labels are looking for big hits and, you know, sort of more teen music, kids music, and it's sort of like that with movies, where you're seeing so many of the major studios releases being animated movies or thrillers, or, you know, with lots of special effects,
right,
or fables like Lord of the Rings. Anyway, it's not what I'm interested in. So that's the way it is with the major labels now, and so they would have no interest in me, and I don't blame them a bit.
I've talked to you a couple times now as you've been in the midst of this musical, so it's interesting to me, because I think the first time that we talked, you know, you were preparing, you know, and then the second time you were about to, you know, roll out with the initial performances. So now you've rolled those initial performances out now, and I know you wrote you and Chip wrote a lot of songs for that initial run, and hearing that you're writing more stuff, I guess I'm curious in its simplest form to know, you know, what you came away with as far as, like, you know, what you learned after those initial performances. You know, did you learn more about, like, here's what we need to do to, you know, make it resonate more? Just curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, yeah, we're not writing many more. We've only written two songs since that first performance, which was two Februaries ago, you know, almost two years ago. There are only two songs, two new ones since then, I think, maybe three at most, but I think it's just two. Okay, that performance was late January, February in Norfolk, Virginia. It was really a success. Did very well for the Virginia stage company. And the verdict with sort of the potential prospective Broadway producers was really like the songs, book needs work. Now that's a standard critique that happens in musicals, but that was the critique for ours of ours. And so we went for the next year working on the book, and I didn't have much to do with it. I sort of feel like, well, that's not my area of expertise, so I'm going to leave it to the people who really feel like they can do this. And so we fooled around with it for the next year, and we had a staged reading in New York last April, which was a complete debacle. We worked on this book for a year and made it worse. And so that really sent us reeling. It was really a bad day in the life, because there were lots of prospective investors there, and we really laid an egg there. It really wasn't good. I'm sitting there wishing there was an eject button I could press, you know?
Yeah.
Since then, we've tried to take a little more creative control/interest in the book. We, meaning my friend DiMatteo and I. So we've been writing this, and now we came up with another book, which is sort of a potpourri of the things we liked the most about both scripts, the Virginia and the New York, I guess for ease of identification. And then we came up with some ideas that led us to write this song, this new song, Life in the Psychotropics. And so that's where we are. But now that, like I said before, we have some great interest from a great person, and we'll see what happens with that. So not much to talk about, not much specific to say about it right now. Too early to talk about it. But yes, but there is promise. But other than that, other than this potential situation that I'm being so enigmatic about, there's nothing other than that. There are just a few people, directors, Broadway directors, and script writers who have interests of, but nobody who's going, man, I've got to be a part of this and make this happen. Yeah. Other than this one, this one person is trying. So we'll see what happens. I keep talking about it though, is because musically, I'm proud of it, and I really like the songs that we've written, and I think it points to it's a new area for me, and musically, and I'm hoping that something happens with it, but at the very least, it gives me new songs to play live, and I like and new songs to be excited about. So the Sick Bastard and the Hunter collaborations, I guess, are my what's exciting to me creatively on a songwriting level, I guess. Yeah. Also, are you guys familiar with the University of Miami program that I started, that I've endowed?
You guys absolutely
aware of that?
Yep.
Yeah, because that's going really well. Speaking of all this music, it's sort of a songwriter's program where you can go into the halls of academia and study, learn how to write and sing and play, or at least that's the aim, the goal. Like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Sonny Boy Williamson, John Lee Hooker, Elmore James, Professor Longhair, Reverend Gary Davis, Bill Monroe, Stanley Brothers, Shaker Hymns, Doc Boggs, Roscoe Holcomb, the Harry Smith Anthology of Folk Music. All this deep well of American traditional music, to me, as the years go by, it's getting lost, and young kids are totally unaware of it. And so there are other programs not unlike this now. I think Berklee College of Music has one, something like this. In fact, I know they do. But I wanted to start something. I think we got there first, though, but I'm not sure. Anyway, it's called the Creative American Music Program, and it's become very difficult to get into. It's become a popular program, and trying to keep the numbers down so the experience is greater for each person. So anyway, that's something that's going on now, too.
Do you get to have some interaction with that at the student level?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've been able to bring some great people. I got Jackson Brown to come do a concert for the program last year, year before. Lamont Dozier came and did a concert. Sean Colvin did one. And so, yeah, it's been fulfilling to see some great people come out of there. The talent level there is high. When Sean came, she was part of this. She was a judge with me at a songwriters showcase, the winner of which opened for Sean the next night. Wow. In her concert. And Sean just looked at me and said, "Oh my God, when I was 20 years old, I wasn't even close to this." And I said, "Yeah, of course, me neither. Not even close." I was trying to be Bud Powell and Bill Evans when I was 20, you know, and doing a pretty bad job of it. But that's been something going on that I'm happy to speak about, because I think it's something that has an impact on some kids.
Jeff, I'll toss to you.
My last question for Bruce, I wondered if briefly you could return with us emotionally to the lounge at the Holiday Inn. And my buddy Matt here is getting married next summer. So I wanted to ask you, if we booked you for his wedding, what you would play.
I actually played a wedding in Chatham, Massachusetts about 5 years ago. Maybe an offer I couldn't refuse to play solo. And basically, they wanted to hear my music. So I said, "Look, you pick the set list." And they did. And so I did that. So it depends on the situation. I played, former Major League Baseball player, a great player named Wally Joyner, who's a good friend of mine. And he hired me to be the surprise musical guest for his wife's, 50th birthday party last year. But he didn't, he just said, "Play what you want." So I ended up, he basically said, "Oh, you know, but play the good old songs." So I said, "Yeah, okay, that'll be fine." So I played a couple of the good old songs right off the bat, and the crowd was fine with it. But then I started playing Sick Bastard musical songs, funny songs, you know, about the woman whose husband drives her so crazy she fantasizes about taking a baseball bat and whacking his head off, called "Where's the Bat?" You might have heard that in Keene, New Hampshire. And you know, the song is about Donald Trump, the Don of Dons, the King of Kings, a sub for the great I Am. These are all Sick Bastard songs. Those are the ones they liked, you know. So they thought they knew what they wanted, but in the end, it really wasn't. They liked the funny songs. And, you know, the Dreaded Spoon from the Skaggs Hornsby record, I just sort of went to the lighter side. I could do it lots of different ways. I could go back and play Brick House like we did in the Ramada. I really wouldn't want to do that, though, to be honest. I probably wouldn't say yes to that. I played That's the Way, enough back then. Not that I don't like it, I just did it enough. So, Bad Leroy Brown, I played it enough. That's what we were playing back then, you know.
I might clear my own wedding because I would request stuff like Swan Song and the moody version of Mandolin Rain, you know?
Yeah, well, that's then we'd be much more amenable to playing that gig. Yeah, absolutely. There's some old soul songs we could do. You know, I grew up in the beach music era here in Virginia Carolinas area. So we could play some classic old songs like "She Shot a Hole in My Soul."
Oh, nice.
some Bill Deal and the Rondells. "What kind of fool do you think I am? Do you think I am now?" Do you know that song?
Yeah.
What kind of fool? Yeah, anyway, that's we would do, you know, some old Drifters, Sam Cooke. I could get into that. So
that's awesome.
So who knows? Make me an offer I can't refuse, like the people in Chatham, Massachusetts did.
There we go. There we go. Well, I'm gonna leave with one here that Jeff had given me when he thought he wasn't going to be able to make it here. You give the impression of being a really well-rounded guy on the musical front. How do you apply that to your personal life, and how do you manage to juggle being a husband, a dad, and a real person against being a touring musician, practicing pianist, and songwriter?
Well, ever since we had our son, our twin sons almost 21 years ago, that's been the real challenge. It's sort of the never-ending guilt feeling. When I'm hanging out with the family, I feel guilty I'm not working on the music. Vice versa, when I'm hanging out, yeah, when I'm working on the music, I feel guilty about being the absentee dad. I've always tried to find a balance. I've loved being a dad, and the boys are just they're great guys. They're both in college playing Division I sports, scholarship athletes. I'm proud to say it's very difficult to achieve what they've achieved, and they're doing it. In fact, my son Keith, I'll be a bragging pain in the ass dad. My son Keith hit 23 points against NC State the other night. So that was fantastic. They lost by 2 back down in Raleigh but last Friday night. So, look, like, for instance, my son Keith, I've helped him out with his hoops game, kind of taught him how to play from age 5 or 6 on, when he showed an ability and an interest. And so I'd love to do it. Same with Russell. My son Russell's a great runner, and he also really interested in flying. He's been a glider pilot since he was 13. So, you know, I've always been very happy and loving to take him over to the Isle of Wight glider port in Isle of Wight County, and Garner glider port in Isle of Wight County, to have him take his lessons. So, you know, who would want to miss any of that? You know, who wouldn't want to be a part of that? It's all just beautiful. And so, I'm lucky that my guys like to come to my concerts. They came to Bonnaroo and heard us play in that great setting. And, they've come to lots of different places since and before and after. So how have I balanced it? I've just done it because I wanted to. You know, I think if you want to do something, you'll do it. And I've just wanted to be really involved in the family life. I'm not sure if that really answered your question exactly.
I think it's sort of close to that. I mean, you're asking me sort of on a level, you know, how are you such a normal guy or whatever. That's a little, I don't know. I don't really like to put that. Because, you know, I probably really am not normal, you know, so. I want to say one thing. Other than the music, and even the music, I don't take that very seriously. I like a lot of the funny stuff, as I say. But generally, I don't take things too seriously. I'm still a bit of a phone pranker and a bit of a prankster. And, you know, we'll go talk gibberish to tourists right around town and ask for fake directions. And so, you know, the great thing about being a musician is you don't really have to grow up.
Yeah.
So I've used that as license to not really grow up and still just, you know, screw around a lot. And speaking of screwing around, I'm sitting in my studio. You get a laugh out of this, maybe. I'm surrounded by all these crazy instruments that I'm actually playing, for better or for worse, on some of this scoring that I'm doing. There's a violin. You'd love to hear me play that. It's just terrible. and there's a kazoo. There's a train whistle. There's a harmonica. There's all sorts of crazy, vibrous slaps and weird, strange percussion instruments. There's some crotales. Here you go. That's the crotales. Here's this crazy thing. We got this little shaker here. And, this thing really has a weird sound. You see what this? There you go. You hear that? Oh yeah, what is it though? So anyway, got a snare drum. So we can make a joyful freaking racket in here, and that's what we're doing. So onward and outward for me.
It's a good life, Bruce.
Sounds like
I can't complain about it. I work my ass off, but I loved doing it. I'm just a grinder, and like I said, a lifelong student.
but I'm really fortunate because I really like to do it. So shed no tears for me.
Right on. Well, thanks for the time, man.
Yes, great talking to you guys. Thanks for being interested. Thanks for being knowledgeable about what I do. As I say often, so often the interviews I do, you know, people really just don't know what it's about, and that's fine. But this is obviously way more fulfilling or enjoyable for me because you guys actually have a clue. So thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure, man.
Thanks for not being clueless.
We try.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it a lot.
Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Take care.
Okay. Bye. All right. Bye.